Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Interpreter Insights Podcast. My topic today is called Joseph the Egyptian, and my guest is my old friend John Gee. Now, before we begin, the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. And if you like this podcast, tell your friends about it. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. So now we're going to reintroduce, if you will, my old podcast co-host, John Gee, who was with me up until last year. John, welcome back to the Interpreter Podcast.
Thank you. Good to be back.
The purpose of this podcast is to introduce people to the folks behind some of the Interpreter articles and some of the Interpreter research. John is somebody who I've known for many years, long before he became the Professor Gee. I wanted to begin, John, by just asking you to tell us about your background, kind of your growing up. But tell us a little about how you wound up from a public school in Lander, Wyoming, to Yale.
Well, I enrolled at Brigham Young University. I got my bachelor's there, and then I went to University of California at Berkeley and got a master's. And because I said I wanted to do Ptolemaic Egypt, and so they said, well, then you need to go to Yale. So then I ended up at Yale, and I did a PhD there. And then through some miracle, I got hired at BYU, and I've been here ever since.
What led you to choose this profession and especially this specialty?
Well, I was wandering through the BYU bookstore back when they had one as a freshman, and they had a little section on languages. And, well, my older brother spotted a book. They had two copies on Egyptian language. So we both bought them.
And was that Clark?
Yeah, that was Clark. And he did something sensible with his life. And then I went and studied Egyptology. But it was a book on Egyptian language. And the book was both really good and in some ways and absolutely awful in others. So the good thing about it is they actually quoted for the exercises and the examples, they quoted real texts. They didn't tell you which ones they were, but they quoted real texts. The one that I remember was the "Grant thou that I may eat the liver of this ox," which makes sense when you actually read it in context, but seems utterly bizarre when you hear it quoted out of context. Normally, when you start with Middle Egyptian. And this quoted from two texts, one from Old Egyptian and the other from Late Egyptian, and none from Middle Egyptian.
Really did you even text. Have an idea about that at that time?
Nope, not at all. And then after my mission, the Ramses II exhibit came through BYU, and they were hiring docents, students to go stand in areas and provide commentary to guests as they went through. They took a class to become a docent, and then you applied, and they decided whether they got you in or not. And they didn't really, you learn the basics about each of the objects, which is basically what you could get by looking at the museum label anyway. But you get a real live person talking to you. And I started there a couple months into it. So everybody rushing to see the exhibit either shows up at the very beginning or the very end. So in the middle of that time, you have your whole shift standing by and talking to the two people who happen to come through every half hour if they want to talk to you. And when they do, they always say, well, what does it say? So you get a lot of time. I wrote down, copied the inscriptions, used some of the resources at BYU to figure out a translation and see how it worked and just. And then you memorize the English translation. And then when they ask you about it, you just regurgitate this memorized translation. But after you do a few of those inscriptions, it's harder to regurgitate the translation. So because I'd worked my way through it, I'd use the glyphs to help me remember what it was supposed to say. And by the time the exhibit left, I could sight read the most of the glyphs in the museum.
Okay.
And it read the inscriptions. What do you do with that? Well, you can go to graduate school and then you can actually study the grammar and find out all the mistakes you've been making up to that point.
What kind of profession did you seek? Did you start out wanting to be a professor of Egyptology?
No, I actually started out wanting to know more about the scriptures. So
Okay.
you take Hebrew, you take Greek, and then what do you do when you've taken both of those? Well, you look at the Pearl of Great Price and you say, well, let's try Egyptian.
Okay. And that's what happened. So what's your master's degree in?
My master's degree is in Egyptology, or is, well, it's in Near Eastern Studies.
Okay. And who were your professors down there at Berkeley?
I had a lot of really good professors. I had Renee Friedman and David Larkin and Terry Moore and Anne Macy Roth and Candy Keller and Carol Redmount. Those are the Egyptologists. Carol Redmount has been the president of the national organization several times, so some people know her. And then I took cuneiform for a couple of reasons. One is, well, that's kind of what they speak in Mesopotamia, but the El Amarna tablets are all written in cuneiform. So I took classes from Dan Foxhaug and Wolfgang Heimpel and Ann Kilmer and Ruggero Stefanini, and so covered the cuneiform bases. I took classes from Moshe Weinfeld when he was a visiting professor, from Robert Alter in biblical studies. I took classical Arabic from John Hayes, and got a fairly wide spectrum of views on these sorts of things. And I went to Yale and took classes on early Christianity from Bentley Layton, took papyrology from Bob Babcock, took Egyptology from Jim Allen and Robert Ridner and Kelly Simpson, took cuneiform from Ben Foster and Bill Hallow and Marcel Sigrist when he was a visiting professor, took classes on Jewish texts from Peter Schaeffer, who then went to Princeton, and Bessel Porton, took Aramaic from him, and took Aegean studies from Karen Foster. I know I'm missing somebody, but anyway, you
Well, we
take a
get the
few.
drift.
Yeah, I mean, some of those people are, or at least were, big names. Some of them still are big names. It was, you could get a learn out about a whole bunch of different things. So I, basically tried to take just about everything that they offered in those fields while I was there.
And then you got your PhD, Egyptology. What's your specialty?
But actually, well, my specialty is Demotic, which is Greco-Roman period Egypt.
What,
My
give us the years on that.
Oh, from about 300 BC to about 500 AD.
Okay.
So almost 1,000 years. Oh, I also got, I shouldn't forget him. I took classes from Stephen Emmel, who is probably the best Coptic scholar in the world right now. And that was incredible. And I also got Coptic papyrology from Terry Wilfong and Sarah Claxton. So most of my professors have passed on. It's sad, but I guess there's a reason I've got gray hair.
Well, how long have you
So
been at BYU now?
I've been at BYU for almost 28 years.
Did you come straight from Yale to BYU?
I did. I was very fortunate that a position opened up. So just to give an example of that. So about the time I got my PhD, American Egyptology was producing on average four PhDs in Egyptology a year. And if you were lucky, there was one job opening per year on average. So there you get this backlog of qualified candidates for a job. So one job I applied to before BYU had 60 applicants. And of course, being junior at the time, I didn't make the first cut. And I remember one job opening that came up and I said, well, this looks really interesting, but who on earth are they thinking is going to fill this job? And he said, oh, you can tell by the way that's written from so-and-so who's forced to retire in Canada. but he can work in the United States after the mandatory retirement age in Canada. And so this university is trying to get him. So they're written the job so that
for
he's
one person,
the only person who could fill it.
Okay.
In Egyptology, generally, you generally have to be one of the best in the world in order to get a position. And even if you are, there's no guarantee you'll get one.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're like Kunnen Donker van Geel in the Netherlands didn't have a position for the longest time. And he was the only person in the world who could, at the time, who could read abnormal hieratic. And so he's the only person in the world who can do this. And he can't get a job.
So what did he do? Did he drive an Uber? Did he, you know, I mean, I know they didn't have Uber then, but
I'm trying to remember what he did. I know Hans Vandenberg did computer programming. Other people have done, I mean, he did finally get a position because mm-hmm. nobody else can do this, right? So
right.
You want to have somebody like that employed. I've heard of them, Egyptologists becoming accountants. I think the most spectacular one or unusual one was one of them became a minor league baseball player.
Wow.
So he was apparently that good.
Oh, well, okay. At least he was able to do something with it.
Yeah.
So that's great.
You know, some of them become tour guides. If you're Egyptian, you can probably get a job in the Ministry of Antiquities there. But for people outside, it's really hard. And it's especially hard in Europe, where they spend all this time, they get a degree, then they go into postdocs, and they can have up to 8 years of postdocs. And then if they haven't got a job at the end of those 8 years, they're just dumped. So they have to completely retool to become something else.
Wow. So what did BYU do in your air field before you came along?
Well, you had Nibley, but he was retired. He retired before I got to BYU.
Yeah.
He still taught. They had some sort of arrangement. Now the law is that after you retire, you have 3 years where you can still teach classes, and then you are out of there. And I understand this is nationwide. They can't really bring you back to teach. Yeah, Nibley taught until one day one of the administrators, without consulting him, changed the grades on his class. And when he found out about it, he says, "I'm done.
I'm not going to do this anymore.
I am not going to have a bureaucrat who hasn't even read the exams."
He was a very independent grader, I will tell you that, having had one of his classes. How many classes did you have from him?
Two officially and two where he took it for credit and two audits. Yeah, he was he had his own way of doing things. And there was a bit of logic behind it, but people didn't know about.
Yeah.
So he would take roll, but not the usual way. He would just go down the list, start on his class roster, just go down the list asking for the opening prayer. And if you were there to give the prayer the day he called on you, then you were marked present for the semester. And people didn't realize that that's what he was doing. And so they would skip. They would blow
off.
We
had 300 for our Pearl of Great Price section that started. And within 2 or 3 weeks, we were down to 30.
Literally. And he's just going down this list, and you're just getting an F for that part of the class because you didn't show up.
Yeah.
And the other thing that, you know, and then he got so he'd have a one question essay final.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I knew what he was looking for. So he'd ask you one question and say, "Don't spend more than 3 hours on this. You can come into class and do it, or you can do it on your own and turn it in."
Yeah.
But, you know, one essay, 3 hours worth of essay. I'll give an example of an actual one. The question was, why should we study the Book of Mormon? And this is in the late 80s. And so he said, "Well, why should we study the Book of Mormon?" And that was the question. He was just furious because most of the answers he got back were because President Benson said so. And they got C's.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And what he was looking for is some evidence that you'd put some thought into it and you'd come up with your own reason why someone should study the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. So in the early 80s, we did that. I had described the seven dispensations as they're contained in the Pearl of Great Price. So my answer was seven pages, single space typed. And okay. I got a B. And he said, you gave me exactly what I asked for. So a friend of mine was in the test block and he heard Nibley mumbling. And Nibley just said, he held up this paper just talking to himself and said, this is what I'm talking about. This person gave me a Greek tragedy and a chorus. This person gets an A. Then my friend immediately erased some of what he'd written and started to do something. I think he got a better grade than I did, but it's because you were thinking outside the box.
Yeah. You were thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
As if you could come up with reasons other than, well, the prophet said to study the Book of Mormon, why you think the Book of Mormon is a book worth studying, you get an A. And I remember after every semester, you get this line of students waiting outside his office to try to argue their grade up. It never worked.
What's been the most important contribution that you have made, not just in your area of expertise?
I've tried to be busy and do work, and I used to get questions all the time. Well, I still get questions all the time, but maybe not quite as much as I used to. Then I've come up with these questions, and so one minute you're having to deal with somebody who's got a question about Greek, and then, you know, the next day it'd be Hebrew, and then it would be... When I started as an undergraduate, I got a job checking Nibley's footnotes. And at the time, I was hoping to do Greek and Hebrew. And they said, well, anybody can do Greek and Hebrew. We need you to do German, and you're hired because you can do German. And at the time, all of the footnote checkers had Greek and Hebrew, and we would fight over all the Greek and Hebrew footnotes. Mm-hmm. A year and a half later, there were two of us that did Greek and Hebrew left. But they said, okay, well, you do German. Here's this source that we've got in an interlibrary loan that we desperately need checked, and it's in Dutch. And you're the closest thing we've got, so please check all the Dutch.
So we've talked about this before. You probably checked more Nibley footnotes than any other human being that we know of.
Well,
that'd be fair to say.
Well, definitely Nibley checked them all.
Yeah.
Well, there's a dispute. So Jack Welch was involved with that, and Stephen Ricks was involved in that, and they both think that they checked more footnotes than I did. And they may be right, but I suspect that as one of the grunt laborers, I probably ended up doing a little bit. But I learned a lot doing that because Nibley was all over the place and he went in depth. Somebody had said, oh, you need to use primary sources, but you can ignore Nibley because he used outdated secondary sources. Now, having checked his footnotes, I knew that wasn't true. Yes, his secondary sources are outdated. So I started going through the Patrologia Graecae, just listing off the various authors where he'd left notes in the margins from his reading. And the Patrologia, you have, say, the Greek text, and you have a Latin translation in the other column. But if you don't read Greek or Latin, you're not getting anywhere. And he was reading the original, you can tell, because his notes are all off of the original text. So I got through about seven volumes and had about four pages, single-spaced, of just listing off the various works that he had done. And I decided that I didn't really want to go through all of the Patrologia, since I knew that for the next 15 to 20 volumes, it was going to be the exact same. Now, towards the end, where all the material's a little bit later, that's nobody didn't really deal with that as much. But I decided that I probably had better things to do with my time than to write up a response to somebody who has probably never read a line of any of those works in the original.
Kind of like arguing with someone on the internet.
Yeah, it's just like, well, is this the best use of my time? Probably not. But going through Nibley and checking those footnotes was an education in and of itself. Nibley was brilliant. He was a gifted writer. I wish I could write half as well as he did. He was encyclopedic, but he had paid the price for that encyclopedic knowledge. and he caught things lots of other people miss. And even in places where in Egyptology where I disagree with him, he was always asking the right questions and answering them the best to anybody's ability at the time. You know, since then, in some cases, things have come out, and some cases, new evidence has come out that he didn't have access to. Other cases, you know, if you'd ask anybody else at the time, you would not have gotten a better answer. Hopefully we have some better answers now. But when we were doing Message to the Joseph Smith Papyri, they suggested, well, maybe we should bring this up to date. You know, and that was, 25 or so years after it came out. And I did a sort of back of the envelope calculation that about 10,000 relevant inscriptions had been published since he came out with his volume. Probably take us, you know, at least 5, maybe 10 years to update. And by the time we got done, it would no longer bear any resemblance to Nibley. So what we did is, in certain key cases where we thought that it desperately needed an update, we put it in the footnote and marked it as the editors and say, this is what's changed in the meantime, but only for a few key issues.
Yeah, but the thing that I recall, he was a pioneer in the initiatory aspects of the Egyptian works that he was working on. And now this is more standard.
It is more standard. It's still not, still some Egyptologists say that this is not, they don't buy it at all. So there are Egyptologists out there who just say there's no initiation. I mean, when you have heavyweights like Jan Osman and Ed Wente coming along, it said, no, this actually is there. And Jean-Marie Christian also has a whole book on that. And so it's more accepted now. It's still not an aspect that most of them feel comfortable dealing with. It's one of the aspects that if you know what to look for, it's, you know, when you're on a tour in Egypt, if you know where to look and point it out, this is Latter-day Saints get this, and they can see it on the temple wall. Mm-hmm. They say, okay, this is this part, this is this part, this part. And they say, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I see it. Yeah.
Yeah, I see it. And you tell them where to look, and they say, and then next temple, they'll say, is this one? Yes, that's one. Yeah. And Nibley wasn't the first to do this, but a lot of it was, it didn't help that you had a number of crackpots promoting that idea. Mm-hmm. And
well,
the crackpot may be a little bit strong, but that's the way most Egyptologists think of them.
Yeah, but he also thought that about some of the Nag Hammadi texts. And yet now recent scholarship says, oh yeah, the books of Jude, the Gospel of Philip, there are initiatory aspects and ritual aspects about those. It's becoming more recognized, I think, and I think Nibley was a pioneer in all of that.
He was a pioneer.
That part of it's upheld.
He was a pioneer in so many things. And you look at all the areas that he went through, you know, he would cite classical authors that many classicists have never heard of. Well, he would quote Oedipus Rex and other things in Greek in his Book of Mormon class. I think it was George McCrae, who's one of the big names way back when. Mm-hmm. And biblical scholars who said, after hearing him give a lecture and then quoting material in the original in the question and answer period, just burying his head in his hands and saying, it's obscene for a man to know that much. Nibley made a lot of contributions, and circling back to one of your initial questions, I suppose one of the things that I've done is that nowadays, when you look about the discussions in the Book of Abraham, most of the discussion is in some ways based on the work that I've done on Book of Abraham. At the end of my master's, I decided that I could try to do what Nibley did, but I wouldn't do it as well. Or I could try to do something of my own, and I just decided I would do one thing differently. So Nibley was really great at seeing patterns by what I call chronologically flattening the field. So if you just ignore the chronological dimension and you can pick certain things from different time periods and see how they're all talking about the same thing, and you just pretend like the chronological difference isn't there, then that helps you see certain patterns that you wouldn't otherwise see. And Nibley was great at that. And another person who was great at that was one of my advisors at Yale, Robert Redner, because he would just chronologically flatten everything as well. The one thing I decided to do that would be different was that I would try to not flatten everything chronologically. There are big advantages to doing that, but try to look at just the material from the appropriate time period. So if we're looking at Joseph Smith papyri, look at first how it interacts with all the material from its contemporary, and then see how things have changed over time. And that's, I think, one of the big differences. Now, of course, the irony is that Nibley was trained as a historian, and I was trained as a philologist, so we should have the reverse situation. But that's one thing I did differently, and I noticed that now when you look at pros and cons on the Book of Abraham, it's more dealing with my material than it is Nibley's. Some of that just may be that nobody reads old stuff anymore, but the field has changed a little. Mm-hmm. And I've done other things. I've done a number of articles dealing with the proclamation on the family, usually from an ancient angle. And this has been published more or less internationally. Elder Packer used to talk about people with gospel hobby horses. I remember one Elders Quorum president I had, whatever the topic was that we were supposed to be talking about in Elders Quorum, it had always ended up on the divinely inspired constitution. I tried to not hit the one note on the keyboard. Mm-hmm. I'll hit the note if you need to play the note, but try to do something else, because the gospel is richer than just a narrow focused specialty. You know, there are whole aspects of the gospel that I will probably never deal with, because mortality is too short. But I will try to bring out the richness in more than just the Book of Abraham.
As I planned this podcast, I was asked to substitute. And so I'm going to be talking about Joseph, who was sold into Egypt. And I ran across this article that you wrote, John, for one of the Religious Study Center volumes a couple of years ago, called From Creation to Sinai. And the article specifically deals with Joseph. So as I've kind of wrap my head around Joseph and his story, I wanted to ask you, and we'll get into some of the details of the article in general in a minute. What is it about this story that you find that rings true? Because a lot of the mainstream scholars say, oh, this is from the Persian era. Some of the rewritten versions in Jubilees, or in particular Josephus, it seems like everybody has a different take on Joseph.
If you looked at periods of history, 200 years ago, the Bible was the oldest book known. We had nothing before the Bible. And then you get this explosion of ancient Near Eastern history and sources. It's challenging to keep up on, and lots of material coming out. And some of it is much older than the Bible now, and a lot of it is contemporary with the Bible. And it's taken a long time for scholars to try to get a handle on that material. And then some of it sheds light on the Bible, and some of them doesn't. Biblical scholars are aware of this other material, but most of them don't deal with it. They'll do New Testament, or they'll do Hebrew Bible. And what's happened with the explosion in all of these sources is one of the periods that has had less of an explosion of material is the Persian period. Since this was a period biblical scholars didn't know much about, then anytime they had something that they either didn't like or didn't want to deal with or seemed strange to them, they would just dump it into the Persian period like it's this black hole. Story of Esther is supposed to take place in the Persian period. So yeah, that's, we can illustrate it in modern times. If you have the idea that certain news sources are not reliable, then you will just discount anything that comes from those sources. Well, biblical scholars largely got the idea that the Bible itself was not reliable at all. And so when they're looking for, and if they want to say, well, okay, I don't think Genesis is reliable, then they would just dump it into the Persian period, which is a little frustrating for those people who actually do work in the Persian period, because everybody assumes that the stuff they don't want to deal with is material that Persian period people will deal with. Now, some of the Persian period people just embrace this. Oh, look, we get to deal with everything. And others of them are saying, now, wait a minute, we're trying to get our period sorted out. And this isn't helping to assign everything to the Persian period. And most of what we have in the Persian period, so, you know, in Egypt and Mesopotamia, you get some really impressive royal inscriptions, Neo-Assyrian inscriptions. You get volumes of, you know, collect a couple hundred inscriptions by Ashurbanipal. But you get to the Persian period, and it's very slim on royal inscriptions. And most of what you've got are day-to-day business documents. And it's the sort of thing that if you went to your local courthouse and started looking at legal documents filed, land transfers, marriage licenses, you would get very little sense of what was going on national politics from that sort of sources. And that's the sort of sources we have in the Persian period. A lot of biblical scholars aren't trained in such a way that would allow them to actually look at, say, the Joseph story in the material from Joseph's time period, which is one of the things I was trying to do with the article.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question, John, is what are the things in the Joseph story that ring true for the Egypt of the period that it is claimed to be set in?
I was trying to show that Joseph fits into the time period, but I just focused on two aspects. One, the clothes involved, and then the other, Joseph's use of cups and the role they play in the story. So they show up in, because he hides his cup inside Benjamin's sack, and the dream of the butler. And here you have to think of butler was for bottler, so they dealt with wine. And that in his dream. And so I just use those as a focal point to talk about some of the stories. There's a parallel to the Joseph story in Egyptian literature. And it's...
Yeah, the guy who became the pharaoh.
Yeah, it's in Papyrus d'Orbigny. Well, people point out the parallels that the guy who became the pharaoh, and Joseph being a foreigner isn't going to be pharaoh, but he becomes
next to pharaoh.
Next to pharaoh, as high as he can go in the government. And people who point out parallels between Papyrus d'Orbigny and the Joseph story never pick that one up. So that's one I wanted to make a point of. And to deal with the sort of story that seems to have parallels between the Papyrus d'Orbigny story and the Joseph story. And chronologically, Papyrus d'Orbigny is written after Joseph, but it's talking about a time period long before Joseph, but it's at least fictionalized, if not complete fiction. So when you talk about dating the various accounts, and you have the whole problem of, well, the account may be written at such and such a time, but the manuscripts that we have for it come from a later time period. So I wanted to look at do some comparison contrast, point out some parallels that are in Papyrus d'Orbigny, the parallel Genesis, that I haven't seen in any of the literature, as well.
Yeah,
as
I saw one, and I'm trying to remember where it was, that's fairly recent, where they mentioned the papyrus that you referred to, but it's the only one that has really talked about that parallel.
I've seen a couple. So there's Victor Matthews and somebody else did a book on Old Testament parallels. And so they have that, but they don't.
They kind of mention it in passing instead.
Well, they draw the parallels. They quote part of the story, but they don't quote the whole thing because not all of it's parallel. There are parallels in Papyrus d'Orbigny to Cain and Abel. But also, how do you deal with these? And I think Robert Alter, talking about type stories, the way that you tell a story, you follow certain tropes, certain patterns, and that's the way you'll tell the story. And there are certain similarities that are there, but there are also certain differences, certain contrasts. And usually when people talk about the parallels, they don't talk about the contrasts. One of the parallels that I found there that I haven't seen talked about is the fact that when they try to seduce Joseph, or in Papyrus d'Orbigny, try to seduce Bata, you get a very terse, blunt statement by the seductress, and then this long explanation and refutation by the protagonist. And the fact that they match and mention some of the same elements, but part of that has to do with the role of the Joseph story in Genesis, because Genesis is put together in such a way that you have Judah's adultery in chapter 3.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, followed by Joseph's keeping the law of chastity in
39. Uh-huh.
And that's deliberate.
Kind of was wondering that as I was looking through it. I go, okay, we've taken a little break. We go through Judah and Tamar, and what does this have to do with anything? But then you get Joseph, who rejects the temptation.
Yeah, so you have these, it's not that the stories aren't historical,
mm-hmm.
but they're juxtaposed in such a way that you can learn something from it. You learn how not to do it the way Judah did it and how to do it the way Joseph did it. And if you look through ancient literature, there's always this didactic purpose that they're trying to teach certain things. And by juxtaposing those two, you can sometimes see how this is different. When Bata's seduced, his refutation is entirely secular.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph mentions God. How can I sin against God? Bata never mentions gods. There's a religious difference there. So we only have one manuscript from Papyrus Dorbeny, and it's from the library of Kinner Hopeshef and Daryl Medina. So it's not widely known. So whoever wrote Joseph, and you're going to put him in the Persian period, then you can't really explain how this papyrus that seems to be only known in this one spot. Now, it probably had a wider circulation, but we don't know of if you're putting Joseph in the Persian period and you want to say they draw in Dorbeny, you've got a 700 or so lag, and you've got something that's attested in only one manuscript in an isolated community in Egypt. And how do you explain the parallels? And the way I would do it is just to say there are certain ways that you tell the story, and they follow those conventions. It's just like if you look at movie screenplays, all the movie screenplays in pretty much the last 20 years are all based on the book Save the Cat.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell you how to put together a story and where to put things, and they're formulaic and they all follow that formula. So you have certain conventions like that. You can see the similarities, but you can also see the differences. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but it would make more sense if you want to say that there are these actual parallels with Dorbeny, then you can explain them by saying, well, Moses is roughly contemporary with Papyrus Dorbeny, so he tells it in a Papyrus Dorbeny fashion, or this is after Joseph goes into Egypt. If he'd been that prominent in the government, then that story can filter through and impact the Egyptian literature. From a scholarly point of view, you then get stuck because you got two explanations which can account for all the data and nothing that really helps you decide which of those scenarios best fits the data. But putting it in the Persian period and saying, oh, it's composed in Babylon, how are they going to find that out?
What are some of the elements that we as Latter-day Saints can take from this? And then also, we have some additional information about Joseph from the Book of Mormon. And
yeah, we do. Joseph we Smith. Do. We have some prophecies of Joseph that are tantalizing.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in 2 Nephi chapter 3, which quotes the prophecies of Joseph, that's the only place you find the expression fruit of my loins. You just don't find that. But it's the sort of thing that you would think you should be able to find. I just haven't. With Joseph's story in Genesis, and just because you don't find something doesn't mean that that's not there or isn't available to be found. I remember one problem I was worked on it for years, and then I realized, oh, I just need to look at it this way. And suddenly something I could find no evidence for, I found a dozen references and inscriptions in an afternoon. But that's because I was looking at the problem correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it wrong, then you don't find it.
There's always been a rumored book of Joseph that Joseph Smith translated.
Yeah.
Tell us what we really know about that or don't know. And I imagine what we don't know is broad, because
yeah, well, what we know is that Oliver Cowdery, in a December 1835 letter to William Fry that gets published in Kirtland, he says that there's a Book of Joseph. That's what we know.
That's it. Found anything. No drafts, no papers, no nothing.
No, nothing. Yeah, we don't know anything about it. But, you know, as far as drafts go, we have three manuscripts of Abraham. Well, we have four manuscripts of Abraham, half of the Book of Abraham we don't have a manuscript for. And half of this published Book of Abraham we don't have a manuscript for. We have missing stuff in the modern times. Maybe there was one, but we don't have any reference in Joseph Smith's journal to him ever working on it. So I don't know what...
It's possible Oliver was mistaken.
Well, I'm not going to assume that Oliver Cowdery was mistaken, but I will assume that Joseph Smith never got around to translating it. And so trying to say anything about it is all speculation. And I like President Oak's exhortation to the BYU students to avoid things that are too speculative.
Okay. Well, on that note, John, we'll end, but thank you for being with us for this episode, and we'll have you on again. This is Terry Hutchinson with John Gee for Interpreter Insights. That wraps up this episode. Please join us again next week. Thanks for listening.